Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 18th of August. We're continuing our series of programs on healthcare reform, and I think this will be a very interesting hour. As you know, we've talked about different countries, and we will continue to do so. But somebody called during one of our shows and said, you know, you should do a program on the kind of healthcare benefits that members of Congress have. And we thought, well, heck, that's a good idea. And so this hour of the show, the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, which is a system of managed competition. Employee health benefits are provided to full-time permanent civilian employees and qualified retirees of the United States government. And it allows insurance companies and employee associations such as labor unions to develop health, dental, and other kinds of plans to be marketed to government employees. It has a very interesting history. I understand that it was signed into law by Dwight Eisenhower many years ago, and we'll talk about what was behind that. Are they enjoying a kind of healthcare system that we should all enjoy? And is it a model for healthcare reform in this country? That's the question of this hour. We are getting tons of phone calls on this issue, so I recommend if you know the issue and you want to call in early and comment on this, or if you have questions about this federal program, the Federal Employees Healthcare Benefits, Health Benefits Program, we'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that. That's talk@wpr.org. It's one of those hours where you know you're going to learn a lot, so you're excited about the hour. Joining us is Professor John Gable. He is Senior Fellow, Healthcare Research Department, National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. And he has been best known for his work managing the Employer Health Benefits Survey, which is sponsored by the Health Research and Educational Trust and the Henry Kaiser Family Foundation. It's an annual survey of employers, and it provides a detailed look at trends in employer-sponsored health coverage, including changes in premiums, employee contributions, and cost-sharing policies. He has written a number of scholarly articles and has done congressional testimony on insurance-related issues before the House Ways and Means Committee, the Federal Trade Commission, and state legislature. And he has served as vice president for the Health Research and Education Trust. And we certainly welcome your phone calls. Professor Gable, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
So give us an outline of what it is that and who all is included in this Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, an outline of their benefits, and who's involved.
Well, it's federal employees and their retirees, and there are many retirees, both early retirees and Medicare age retirees. I would say the first thing I would want to make is that I don't really think the federal employees plan is that different from many of the plans that large employers have. It has more choices, although the old, I can remember not that many years ago, General Motors had more than 100 plans that it was offering to its employees. I would say something's a little different than maybe some employers is that it does seem to very actively negotiate with the health plans for the price of the plans. But I really don't think that it's that different. Now, there's a perception somehow or other that congressmen are getting Cadillac plans and the federal employees plan is a Cadillac plan. Mm-hmm. It is not a Cadillac plan. Its actuarial value for the largest plan with about 50% of the membership, which is the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, mm-hmm. is about 82 or 83%. That means for a large population, about 82 or 83% of the bill is paid by the health plan, and the remainder is paid out of pocket by the federal employees and retirees. Now, the average for all group of health insurance in this country is about 80% or 81%, so it's a little richer than the typical plan, but not much richer than the typical plan.
And why do most of them choose this Blue Cross Blue Shield plan? Is there a significant difference among the plans?
It's a PPO plan. It's a fee. Most of the other plans are HMO plans.
I see.
There used to be an Aetna plan it competed with. The Aetna plan thought that they were getting the sicker employees and retirees, and eventually exited from the market. So that enabled the Blues plan to increase market size.
Mm-hmm. They also have, I've been reading, access to some federal facilities and to physicians top, maybe better, well, physicians for the most part are qualified, but really top-notch physicians in the area. Is that true or not?
Well, I think I don't think they're that different from most health plans in the United States. Most health plans, most PPO plans in the United States, sign up virtually as many doctors as they can, and as many hospitals as they can. This has been a real change in philosophy from the managed care era of the 90s, when the idea was you want to sign up about one-fourth of the hospitals and doctors in the area. And that way, you would have more leverage and get higher discounts with those doctors that you sign up. But I think in general in the country now, what we're finding is that the networks are very broad, and the only doctors that don't seem to be willing to participate in most networks are doctors that are serving very upscale areas, upscale communities, and have a clientele that can pay a lot out of pocket.
Mm-hmm. What about the, and I'm wondering where this is across the board too, but what about this part of the program, federal workers being eligible for coverage no matter what their health? So you don't have to worry about pre-existing conditions.
Yes. But that, again, I don't think that's different than most large employers in the country. Pre-existing conditions, as I can recall, were pretty much banned if you already had coverage when you moved in by a 1997 act of Congress called HIPAA. What it stands for, I have long since forgotten. the use of pre-existing conditions in the group insurance market has declined dramatically since the passage of that bill. Where we still see the use of pre-existing conditions clauses is in the individual insurance market.
Mm-hmm. So on the whole, you would say that this is not a Cadillac of plans. It's not the best in the country. It's comparable on an even keel with good private insurance from big companies.
I would say yes. I would say that is correct. It is not a Cadillac plan. It costs a lot. But why does it cost a lot? It costs a lot because it has a very old population that it is covering. It has almost as many retirees that it's covering as active workers and their dependents. Yes, and its coverage, its actuarial value is really not that much different from most other plans of large employers. I would also note that one aspect of the plan this is the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan that is worse than a typical group plan is the out of pocket maximum limit is $5,000. Whereas a typical group insurance plan, that figure is usually $2,000 or $3,000. Mm-hmm. And again, that's why I say this is not a Cadillac plan.
Right. Is it true, I read somewhere, that this plan was adopted during the Eisenhower administration because his mother-in-law was very, very sick and required years of medical care that took a financial and emotional toll on the president? Is that just a story, or is that indeed how and when it started?
I will have to plead ignorance on that story. This is the first time I have heard it.
Huh. Okay. Well, now I have to research it too to see if indeed it is true. Where do we get this perception in the country? Does it come from people who don't have insurance, or does it come from people who work for smaller businesses? And many people work for smaller businesses that members of Congress have it made that they got something that we don't have, and shame on them. And or as we're talking about health reform, we all deserve what it is that they have.
I think it's sort of the pitchfork populism that we have in the country. And I think the congressmen and the senators fuel it. I mean, saying, look, we have this very good plan, and the American public deserve a plan just as good as the one we have. You know, many times there's myths that once they start being repeated, they have a life of their own.
Oh, that's interesting. And you also have politicians, the president even saying recently that he's got a great health care plan. Many of them in talking about reform saying, well, you know, I have a great health care plan.
Correct.
When you look at satisfaction, I know you do have done surveys of all kinds of programs. What do the federal employees who are members of the health benefits program, many of them and the retirees are, how do they rate their care?
They rate their have high levels of satisfaction. In general, in this country, for most employers, you do have high levels of satisfaction. You have this this sort of paradox, I guess, about, I mean, this goes even beyond healthcare. People will say they're not happy with the U.S. healthcare system, but I'm happy with my doctor and I'm happy with my health plan. Just as they will say, Congress is a bunch of crooks, but I like my representative, and the schools in this country are horrible, but the school system in my county is very good.
Right. But there are a significant number of Americans who work for smaller companies. I can't remember the exact percentage, and they're not very happy.
They're not as happy. The people who are usually the most unhappy with their health plan are the people who use their health plan a lot. And you have this group out there that uses almost no health care. Remember that the healthiest 50% of any employer's plan will roughly account for 3% of the spending. These people use very few services, and they're very happy with their health plan.
Mm-hmm. So should we be looking at a federal plan getting, I guess it'd be sort of hard. You can talk about expanding Medicare, but it would be hard to look at a federal employee's health care as a model for everybody because it already is kind of a model for big companies.
Well, I think we could begin with what the federal employees plan has, and I think we would need to add some elements to it that it does not have. I would say, for one, it doesn't have risk adjustment. Now, risk adjustment is a living for economists and actuaries. So if we have, let's say, 50 plans competing with one another with federal employees, you don't want to reward an insurer that has very healthy employees who don't have many services. They don't use many services. And they don't use many services because they're healthy.
Right.
So we try to do risk adjustment, which would statistically adjust across the plans as if all the people had the same set of employees that they were covering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is something you need, or you will end up with what in the insurance business we call the death cycle. Because once you get a plan which attracts the very sick people, then what will happen is that the premiums will go up higher and higher and higher for that plan, and it will go out of business.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly something that could be added to the federal employees plan. I think that would be very useful.
Mm-hmm. We'll take phone calls on this because we'll probably get calls on all aspects of this. We're continuing our series of programs on healthcare reform. And this hour, we are looking at what federal employees have, the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor John Gable. He's Senior Fellow, Healthcare Research Department at the National Opinion Research Center, University of Chicago. He is known for his work managing the Employer Health Benefits Survey that is sponsored by the Health Research and Educational Trust and the Henry Kaiser Family Foundation. It's a survey of employers providing a detailed look at trends in employer-sponsored health coverage, including changes in premiums, employee contributions, and cost-sharing policies. To your phone calls in a moment, and we have all our lines busy, so keep trying. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Gary from Madison. Hi, Gary. Hi, Gary. Are you there?
Oh, yes. Hello. I just hit a little slight dead spot with my cell phone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Hi. Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Dr. Gable.
Hi.
I have a couple points, actually two main points I'd just like to address about the differences there might be. One is the difference in what happens, what the coverage after retirement and how many years you need to work to get full retire. Full health insurance after you retire. For example, for example, the state of Wisconsin. Okay, people think the great benefits they have, but if you're an employee, a union type employee, not the teachers, but the common custodian, maintenance worker, whatever, you could work 30 years for the state of Wisconsin, retire at I don't know if you're lucky enough to retire at 58 or something, you get no health coverage, no health insurance coverage paid for. You have to pay it out of your own pocket from that point on. And I'm wondering if federal workers get that paid for if they retire after 30 years and they're 55. Because that's a huge difference to an individual.
Okay. And before you get to point two, let's do point one.
Sure.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Professor Gable?
Feeling aspect of working for the federal government now. I'm not sure how many years it is that you need, and maybe it's 10 years or so, but they do get retiree health benefits. They are enrolled in the same plan that they were while they were active employees. They have to contribute more for their health insurance, but it is wonderful coverage.
So they would do that if they get to be 90 years old?
They keep till death do us part.
Huh. And why wouldn't they participate in Medicare?
Well, I think what happens is that once they do reach Medicare age, Medicare becomes the prime payer, and that their federal employee health insurance becomes their secondary payer.
I see. Gary, I know you had more.
Yes, just the second part was the actual part that you might pay per month, your share of the premium. For example, you might compare this like you compared it to a lot of private companies and insurance, they offer. But is that person paying $200 or $300 a month his share for that coverage, where the federal employees maybe are paying nothing or $20 per month?
In general, I can say for the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, which is probably a more expensive plan, in general, federal employees pay a higher amount for their monthly premiums than do the typical employee in this country who has group health insurance. I think a very important point here is that it's not completely true, but it is a fixed amount is contributed by the federal government at some point. At some point, it doesn't contribute more, so that if an employee chooses a more expensive plan, they're bearing the financial risk for choosing that more expensive plan. And of course, this is a strong incentive for the different health plans to keep their costs down and to keep their premiums down.
Do you have, if I might ask, do you have any idea? Is it like in the $50 or $75 range?
Oh,
for
gosh, it's higher. The average in the country is about $62 or so. And for the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, it's considerably more than that. It's in the hundred. It's over $100, I believe, a month.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, and just a last comment, and I'll let you go. But, that's one of the issues, too, about just in comparing what health coverage people have. It can sound great, they offer this coverage, but in some cases they're paying $200 to $300 a month out of their own pocket to get that coverage that looks fine, and it just doesn't seem to come up in the discussion too often, you know, or often enough in the healthcare insurance debates. So that's all. And I'll let you off the air. Thank you. I mean, I'll hang up, and thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you, Gary, for your call. $62 a month, the average. Has that gone up significantly in the last few years? Or
Well, if you go back about 7 years ago, or 8 years ago, it's double what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more than double for family coverage. That's in absolute terms. If you look at the percentage of the total premium contributed by employees as opposed to the employer, the percentages remain relatively constant. I mean, what has happened is that the pie, the cost of health insurance, the pie is getting bigger and bigger, and the share paid by employees has remained relatively constant.
I see. And that $62 average is a family or?
Single. That's single.
And family is?
Family would probably I wish I had opened up my book. I'm thinking family's around $200 a month.
$200 a month. Okay.
That might be too low.
Right. Let's go to Bill next from Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I just wanted to say that we're talking about two different things. You're talking about health insurance. You're not talking about health care. Everyone in this country has access to health care. You just have to pay for it. When I was young and single, I racked up several thousands of dollars in healthcare bills and didn't have any money. I paid them off $5 at a time, and they, by law, couldn't send me the collections. And as I grew in economic stature, I paid it off. And I don't think that just because you have the ability to exist, that you have a right to health insurance. That is something somebody needs to work for or pay for. Thank you very much.
What if you have a catastrophic illness?
I was in an accident and broke my leg. What if?
Yeah.
You work on it until you pay it off, or your family does. I mean, we have the right to, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not the guarantee of health insurance.
May I reply?
Oh, of course.
First of all, but the way we subsidize health care and health insurance in this country is through the employer-based system. What the employer contributes for my health insurance is not taxable income. So my plan that I have at the National Opinion Research Center cost almost $18,000 a year. With the employer's contribution, I am getting a tax subsidy of about $6,000 a year. The way the system works, the higher your income is, the bigger the subsidy you get. So if I were a retail clerk at some big chain store, they probably don't offer health insurance, and I get $0. If I'm a wealthy person, I get a big subsidy. So we have, in fact, a system of subsidies, which means that the have-nots get nothing, and the people who need the support the least get the most. So let's be realistic about this. The fact is, the reason why we have uninsured people is because of the set of incentives that says a wealthy person gets a big subsidy, somebody who's a retail clerk, a cab driver, a part-time hospital worker, they get nothing.
Thanks very much for the call. Jennifer from Green Bay, hi.
Hello.
Hello.
That brings up another point compared, like, with my point. If you are not insured for 6 months or more, excuse me, in between insurances, then pre-existing conditions appear. That's what I ran into. I went to the chiropractor, discovered that I should go to the chiropractor, and then I didn't have my insurance yet, because I just started a job specifically with the idea of getting insurance for me and my husband. I would love to be doing what I went to school for, but it doesn't offer insurance. And the realism is, you know, babies happen, life happens. One of us needs to have a job with insurance, and it turns out it's going to be me. I didn't go to school to work in a call center. I went to school to be an archaeologist.
Hmm.
And my parents, the whole small group thing, yeah, when the insurance company looks at you and says, oh, I'm sorry, your small family business, you don't have enough employees to be a group. We're sorry. You're on your own now. I mean, there's just so many things fundamentally wrong with this private system. I mean, I am locked into a career now that I did not go to school for because I need insurance. And I just think that's absurd.
May I comment?
Of course.
I think the caller illustrates one of the primary reasons we need to change the system. And the caller is correct. There's a gap in coverage. All of a sudden, when you buy individual insurance, you are subject to pre-existing condition clauses. The fact, what we should think about healthcare reform is changing the rules of the game. If the fundamental fact is this, the health insurance system left to itself is a dysfunctional system. It is a system which, left to itself, insurers will compete by looking for healthy people and excluding people who really need health insurance and need health care. In fact, think of this, even that not just individual insurance, but it's the rules of the market that an employer must charge the same premiums to all the employees, no matter how sick they are, that they cannot kick people out of the employer plan if they are sick. It is the rules that make this possible. But if the market, but if there were no rules limiting this, insurers left to themselves would exclude all these people from the market.
Sure.
So what we need to do is change the rules of the marketplace. And let me say this, you cannot get the kind of healthy competition, the competition on quality and price, unless you change the rules of the marketplace. So you don't allow insurers to compete based on excluding healthy people. Now, it's not because the insurers are evil people. It's because the economics of the marketplace dictate this. Remember, the sickest 1% of employees are likely to constitute about 27% of the total expenses, and the sickest 5% about 50% of the expenses. And based on your past use of services and your medical conditions, you can predict with some accuracy who's going to be a high user and who's going to be a low user. So the natural consequence is to exclude sick people unless you have rules in the marketplace that don't permit this.
Do you have an idea of where we should be going with reform?
I think in general that the reforms that are being discussed are generally speaking in the right direction. I mean, there are things I would like them to do which are not being advocated, which would be politically unpopular, and these would be more stringent ways to control cost. But certainly, let me go just a little bit further on this point. If you want to outlaw medical underwriting, which means no pre-existing conditions, that you cannot charge people higher premiums based on their medical history, then the next step is you have to have an individual mandate. You have to require that every single person, American, is covered by health insurance. Why is this? You can't have one without the other. The reason is if you say no medical underwriting, but buying health insurance is optional, then I can wait till I get sick and then buy health insurance.
Right. I see your point, yeah.
So in other words, the insurance companies will be in a position which is totally unfair to them. And you know, there's an old saying in insurance, you can't buy fire insurance when your house is on fire.
Right. Yeah. Let's go to more phone calls. Jennifer, thank you so much for your call. Mike is next from Appleton. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I got a question and then a comment. Perhaps your guest can help clarify something. I go into a doctor's office and there's, 20 people there, of which, let's say, 15 have health insurance and two are there for Medicare. And so I know that the patient who's there for Medicare, the doctor's really not going to receive that much. And so the other 15 people who are there on private insurance are going to pick up part of that tab. Is that the way that, you know, in a nutshell works? And then the comment I wanted to make was, you know, hey, tough luck for the insurance companies. They've been driven by greed for years and years and years. You know, if they had not been so greedy about their bottom line 10, 20 years ago, and had given, you know, more flexible coverage to people, we probably wouldn't have this problem today.
Well, your question, is there a cross-subsidy that's going on among the patients? Yes, there is. The Medicare payment is about 20% less for physician fees than what the private insurers pay. And this is true in hospitals also. So there is a cross-subsidy going on. And, of course, the biggest cross-subsidy of all is for patients who have no health insurance. But the surprising thing is, in the hospitals, that actually the charges to the uninsured patients are about three times what the private health insurance company will pay. Now, of course, this becomes a list price, not a... not an exchange price. I mean, think of it as a used car dealer. They have a list price and then what you actually buy it at. And of course, any hospital or any physician's office that has a lot of uninsured patients is a hospital or doctor which is facing severe financial problems. With regard to the insurance companies, I just have to say, I think, again, it's not that insurance companies are evil people. It's the rules of the game. And if you make the rules of the game so they can't do certain what I consider antisocial activities, I think that you will see that the type of competition among insurers will be healthy competition, which makes for a more efficient healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Should the, for symbolic reasons or for fairness reasons, do you think that federal employees, once we get some kind of health reform, if we get some kind of health reform, need to be a part of whatever the new system would be? If it's a government plan, if it's a co-op kind of plan, whatever it is, they should be there.
Well, I think, as I read the current reform proposals, these proposals with regard to coverage are an expansion of the current system. So if you are a large employer, you will continue to provide health insurance to your employees, and federal employees will be just like other large employers and will continue to offer health insurance to their employees.
Okay. Mike from South Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. I call in once a week every time I hear this healthcare debate. I'm a retired physician, and I'll keep saying the same thing. We as a country spend $2.4 trillion on healthcare. If we spent comparable to other westernized countries, we would be spending about $1.6 trillion and covering anybody, everybody. I live in a community of about 25,000 people. We have one high school. It's a public high school, a socialized high school, socialized education. We need a similar model for health care. It's ridiculous. If my community, if we had the same type of model for education, would have two or three high schools. And we as a society have decided that public education is beneficial to society, and we need a public option, just as Howard Dean has said. That is the only way we're going to solve this problem, because we are wasting tons of money and resources that we don't have. We spend $2.4 trillion, and we could be spending one-third less in covering anybody, everybody. And I'd like to have that issue addressed by the president. We're spending too much already, and we're not getting the bang for our buck. That's my comment.
Thanks for the call. Professor Abel.
I agree that we're not getting our bang for our buck, that we spend twice as much as any other country in the world, and that our health outcomes are actually maybe slightly worse than other industrialized countries. Here's where I disagree. It's not a political possibility in this country to have a single-payer system. You could not get 60 senators to vote for it. And you can not, the public opinion polls I've seen, maybe as many as 40% of Americans would support a single-payer system, but
it would, you could not, I just don't see how you could get it through Congress. And in general, Americans are distrustful of government. They are distrustful of concentrated power. And though I would say, for example, the Canadian system and the French system and the German system work very well, the Swiss system works very well, I just don't think it's a political possibility in this country.
We got Medicare through Congress.
Right. That, you know, well, you know, of course, that's one of the great ironies. it's the great irony is once it got through, it's political. Nothing is more politically popular. But you know, I've seen many public opinion polls, and Americans just don't want to go that direction.
We go to thanks, Mike, for your call. Carl from Fond du Lac. Hi.
Hi. This is Tom.
Oh, it's Todd. Well, what a surprise.
Tom from Fond du Lac.
Todd. All right, Todd.
Yes, my question is, the opponents of this single-payer program or whatever it is called say that it's going to cost so much more. But it seems to me that everybody who wants health care is getting it today. If they don't have insurance, they show up at an emergency room and they have to be treated. And the cost of that is just added on to the general overhead, which is paid for by people who have insurance. So where is this additional cost coming from?
Okay. Well, first of all, it is not true. This country rations health care. It rations health care on ability to pay. The uninsured get about one-half as much care as people who have health insurance. They do not get their prescription drugs. If you go into an ambulatory surgery center, you won't find uninsured patients. You won't find them getting hip replacements. So they don't get the same health care. When they're admitted to a hospital, they're much sicker when they're admitted to a hospital. They get fewer services in the hospital. They're discharged sooner. They're more likely to die sooner. Their life expectancy is about one-fourth shorter than people who have health insurance. So the people who don't have health insurance do not get the same health care. If we cover them, although right now we have this, as the caller correctly indicates, that the set of cross-subsidies that pay for their some of their coverage, there's also certain government subsidies. But if we do... If these people get health insurance, we can expect that they're going to use almost twice as much health care as they are currently using. Now, studies do indicate, though, that even when the uninsured do get health insurance, they tend to use not quite as much services as other Americans. But initially, there's going to be a lot of pent-up demand. So that's why it will cost more, because the uninsured currently do not get the same services as other Americans. Now, here's an interesting thing, though, why it's in the self-interest of everybody, I believe, to have universal coverage. If you look in those areas of the country, this is the Institute of Medicine report. If you look in those areas of the country where there are lots of uninsured, when we measure quality of care, those are the parts of the country that seem to have the lower quality of care. So there seems to be even a little spillover effect to the insured population when you have large segments of the population uninsured.
Well, it's also just the moral thing to do. I mean, you have to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. And we're all a job away from that or a medical catastrophe away from that. And somehow we don't seem to be able to do that.
I agree.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor John Gable, Senior Fellow, Healthcare Research Department, and that's at the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. We have one line open if you'd like to take it. We're looking, and our conversation, of course, goes a little beyond this, as all of our healthcare conversations have. We've been looking at the program that federal employees enjoy, and we're also looking at various programs and plans and ideas that need to be a part of healthcare reform for all Americans. So, back to you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back to phone calls. ID from Evansville. Hi.
Hi. Just a side comment. Another practical reason for universal health care is communicable diseases like the flu. But what I called about was my brother, who had insurance with one of the insurance companies in New Jersey, and then they pulled it out of there, and he was dropped. And then he decided to go into business for himself. It was a big leap, and you know he was in debt, and he didn't have the money, so he didn't go to the doctor. And so then he started getting ill, and he didn't know it. He was depressed and ill, and so he made less money. So he still didn't go to the doctor. Well, 2 years ago, he finally went, and he had a 50-50 chance of living. He had an enlarged heart, and his kidneys had shut down. So he was so poor, he finally got health care. So he spent 2 months in the hospital, and then he had to have rehab. And so here's a person, you know, he's recovered some now, but he's permanently disabled. He's 52. But here's a person who tried to go into business, and because he was struggling at first, he didn't really feel he had the money to go to the doctor, and so and then it spirals downhill to where his business fails, and he's almost dead. And just recently, he was avoiding seeing the doctor again because he's covered for health issues but not dental care. And he ended up having an impacted tooth that was almost infected to the bone. And as people who have heart conditions know, this can, you know, be really serious. And so I just sit there and I think, you know, if he lives with my mom, and she's 82 and she's disabled, but he's well enough that he can, you know, he feeds her and she's sharp as a tack. But the thing is, if he weren't there, my mom probably would have lived with me. But because he's there with her, she's not in a home somewhere. I mean, what do you have to be, dirt poor to get health care? You have to be so poor. And so it's not good for it's not good for business not to have insurance, universal insurance. And I think more people would take the risk of going out on their own and trying something new and being creative if they knew that they'd be covered. I mean, I'm in the same position. I love my job, but I can't leave it because, you know, I have health coverage. Yeah. And I have, you know, that's the deal. So that's thank you deal. For listening to that.
That's the deal. A lot of people have similar deals. Professor Gable, what a story, huh?
Yeah, it's. I think it illustrates all the many human lives that are really destroyed by us having a system of health care which rations on ability to pay, that says that when you really need health care, the insurance companies don't want to give it to you and can't afford to give it to you. And I think the caller's point is very well taken. I mean, by not having universal coverage, if you believe that the small employers of this country are the real engine of our economic growth, then this healthcare system is an impediment to having some of our creative people go into business for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mike from Milwaukee next. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Just two questions here. The one is, you know, everybody talks about Europe and how well the system works there, but in Europe, people are taxed at 50%, and then you throw another 10% sales tax. So if we're going to have universal care, we are going to end up paying more tax. So now I think of myself, if I'm paying more tax, I'm not going to make my mortgage payments, I'm not going to make my car payments, I'm going to run into problems. So either we pay more tax and we downscale our standard of living. We'll have to have smaller cars like in Europe, smaller houses like in Europe, or we keep to the system that we've got now and we've got bigger houses, bigger cars. But you cannot have universal health care without taxing people. So if we're going to end up paying 55% tax for universal health care, well, then so let it be. Now, but then we must just realize many people won't be able to pay their mortgage payments. You know, you can't have it both ways. Now, the other one is, I mean, I take myself. I don't smoke. I regularly exercise. I keep my weight in check. I eat healthy foods. I don't drink sodas. Why should people like myself end up paying for people that don't exercise, that smoke, that drink a lot of sodas? You see what I'm getting at? And if it's universal health care, then you know the healthy guys are paying the bill. I mean, anybody can be in an accident. But why should people that be penalized? Because I try and keep my weight in check. I try and keep my lifestyle in check, that I'm healthy, I end up paying the bill for somebody that doesn't. You know, so this socialist system is you know, as Margaret Thatcher said, eventually you run out of somebody else's money.
Well, if I can reply to, first of all, nobody's advocating a socialist system. What is being discussed is an expansion of the current system. If we went to universal coverage, it will cost an estimated $100 billion a year extra. That's on a system of $2.4 trillion. So the amount of new taxes is very, is, you know, compared to the entire U.S. budget, this is very small. I also would want to note, though, I believe that we could, if we would take really strong cost control methods, which are politically unpopular, I believe that we can pay for it through efficiencies of the healthcare system. This is not shared by the Congressional Budget Office. I feel the Congressional Budget Office has historically underestimated savings from certain cost control methods. Now,
but before you go on, what kind of methods are you talking about?
50% tax rate in Europe, it has to do with a much stronger social net than the U.S. Don't attribute that to health care. We would be spending, they spend less on health care than we do.
And when you talk about cost control, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, would be some examples. Let me say the most, if you're going to say, why does healthcare go cost more and more every year? Why is this a system out of control? It is because we have a combination of third-party payment and fee-for-service payment. If you pay, you get what you pay for. And if you pay doctors to do a lot of procedures, you get a lot of procedures.
Right.
We need to move the system away from fee-for-service medicine, so doctors get paid, let's say, somewhat on procedures, somewhat on quality of care, maybe a fixed amount per patient. This will have enormous savings, I believe. You could comparative effectiveness would be very important. We need better information to know what works very well and what doesn't work well, and how much does it cost. And I don't basically, this is not being advocated now, but I mean, I basically believe, let's take the hypothetical. If you have two medications and they are equally effective and one costs $100 a month and the other costs $5 a month, I believe that the insurer should only pay $5 a month for it if they are equally effective. Or at least start with the $5 a month medication, and if that doesn't work, then try the other one. We have some savings in the system if we have what's being called a healthcare exchange, which is a purchasing pool, which will make health insurance much cheaper, reduce the administrative cost for small group and individual insurance. These are just some of the changes which I think are very necessary in the system, which can make the system much more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call, Mike. Let's go to Tina from Oshkosh. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I'm just wondering if you can tell me why we're not talking more about having a sugar tax, an overall sugar tax on table sugar, high fructose corn syrup, things that are making us unhealthy and sick and burdening the healthcare system, white flour, you know, those kinds of things. And I'd also, you know, we're talking a lot about other countries like Japan and France, and they're getting more bang for their buck. They don't eat like us in America. We're making ourselves sick.
Well, I agree with you. I would like to have a sugar tax. I'd like to have a higher tobacco tax. I think studies show that if you raise the price and you raise it a significant amount, people will consume less of it. I think some people have said the biggest advance in the war on cancer was the tax on cigarettes, raising the price of cigarettes and keeping many people from ever beginning smoking. So I think that's a good idea, but it isn't politically popular. And yes, I think if you compare the United States to the Great Britain, for example, there was a recent study about a year ago. They are healthier at every strata of socioeconomic status than the United States.
despite the fact their healthcare system is costs about 40% about what ours does. And when if you look at lifestyle, we've got a better lifestyle than the British on almost every single area. I mean, in other words, they're more likely to be heavy drinkers, they're more likely to smoke. But the one thing that we look much worse than that on is obesity. And yes, obesity, whatever is necessary, obesity is a major contributor to rising health care costs in this country.
Thank you so much for being with us this hour, Professor Gable. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.
Sure. Our pleasure. Our guest this hour, Professor John Gable, looking initially at the healthcare system that federal employees enjoy and broadening the conversation a bit to talk about what is necessary, he believes, in any kind of reform to our healthcare system, our new system that we may be developing. He's at the University of Chicago, Senior Fellow, Healthcare Research Department. Thanks to Jolema Noel for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in Milwaukee and for your calls. We thank you. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and I'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network.